Farmers of the Court. We present the dramatic story of our court, where daily the unbiased administration of justice is dealt to rich and poor alike. These dramatizations in fictionized form are typical of the human interest dramas that daily crowd our courts. Tonight, the trial of Frank Stevens.
Gentlemen of the jury, the administration of good government is based upon a sound judicial system. In considering the case before you, weigh carefully all the evidence and be convinced beyond all reasonable doubt of the guilt or innocence of the accused before delivering your verdict.
The Crown versus Frank Stevens.
One November Friday, in a large eastern city, shortly before noon, Rita Manville, bookkeeper in the Clayton Canning Company, left the factory to draw the week's payroll. Frank Stevens, the foreman, accompanied her as her bodyguard. She drew the money, some £2,000, put it in her brown leather briefcase, and started back from the bank with Stevens. A short time later, Constable Hastings, on beat duty, suddenly heard the sharp crack of three shots in rapid succession, followed by a woman's piercing scream. Hastings made his way to a lane between two large buildings. At the entrance to the lane stood the foreman, Frank Stevens, a smoking gun in his hand. He was looking frantically up and down the street.
Ian?
Did I see who?
Well, hold up, man. We were coming through this lane on our way back from the bank and stepped out of a doorway and grabbed the briefcase with the money in it away from Rita.
There's been a robbery.
Oh, and she fought with him. He shot her, and then he took a pot shot at me and ran away. I followed him up the lane and fired at him a couple of times. I must have missed, I suppose, because when I got to the entrance here, he was gone.
Hey, wait a minute, wait a minute. Who's Rita and who's been shooting who and why?
Well, Rita Manville, our head bookkeeper, and I were carrying a payroll when this fellow...
First of all, what are you doing with that gun in your hand?
Oh, it's mine. I told you I was trying...
And where's this Rita?
Lying back there in the lane. I'm afraid she's hurt bad.
Huh. Well, come on, let's go back and see.
I want to have a look at this gift.
Oh, come on. Constable.
Yes, miss. What is it?
Bend over. I'm dying. Constable. Listen.
Get a doctor. Get an ambulance.
Wait a minute, wait a minute. She's trying to tell me something. She's sitting up. She's pointing.
Constable. He shot me. He shot me.
She's dead. She was pointing at you. She said you killed her.
No, it wasn't me. She was out of her head.
We'll see about that. You're under arrest.
Because of Rita's dying accusation and other evidence, Stevens was committed and tried for murder. 2 months later, a packed courtroom heard Hastings tell the story of how, with her last breath, the dying girl accused Stevens. His evidence was damning, but the defense showed every sign of confidence as he cross-examined.
Constable, you say the girl sat up and said someone shot her?
No. She said he shot me and pointed at the defendant.
Did she say Stevens shot me?
No.
Just... he shot me?
Yes.
Hmm. Where was Stevens when she pointed?
Next to me.
Was there anybody behind the two of you?
Why, yes. A crowd of people had followed us into the lane.
Couldn't Miss Manville have been pointing at someone behind Stevens?
Well, it seemed to me she was pointing right at him.
Now, isn't it a fact that she was bleeding profusely as she lay there in the lane?
Yes.
Was her voice strong when she spoke to you?
No, it was quite weak.
Was it steady or shaky?
It was shaky.
She seemed in great pain.
Yes, she did.
So on the basis of what this dying woman in great pain, shaky and weak, said, and for no other reason, you arrested the defendant?
I did.
Did you take the gun from the defendant?
Yes.
What caliber was it?
.38 caliber.
Did you find any other gun in the defendant's possession? Or anywhere about, in the lane, the street?
No, I did not.
And that's all.
Thank you.
Several witnesses who had been in the lane when Rita died corroborated the constable's testimony that Rita had pointed to Stevens, but none of them could swear to it. A police surgeon then testified the girl had been killed by two .32 caliber bullets, and the defense at once pointed out that the gun Hastings took from Stevens was not the murderer's gun, as it was a .38. Then the Crown called Robert Clayton, owner of the factory, a dignified, white-haired man of 60. After he had stated that Miss Manville had worked for him as bookkeeper for 16 years and Stevens as foreman for 7, and that they were both valuable employees, the Crown prosecutor asked,
"Did Stevens and Miss Manville cooperate with each other at all times?"
For a time they did, but about a year ago they began to disagree with each other about nearly everything. They were always snarling and fighting. I talked to Stevens about it. He said he didn't understand it, that Miss Manville seemed to have taken a personal dislike to him.
Did you ask Miss Manville what the trouble was?
I did, and she said one day in my office...
"I don't trust Stevens, Mr. Clayton. That's why I fight with him."
"Don't trust him? What do you mean?"
"You know our last inventory showed £650 worth of goods not accounted for by sales?"
"Peter, for heaven's sake, are you accusing Stevens?"
"Stevens is the only one in the factory besides yourself who has the keys. I tell you, he's been robbing you right and left."
"Wait a minute. What's that you said about me?"
"Eavesdroppers seldom hear any good of themselves."
"Not when they listen to suspicious old maids. Mr. Clayton, this woman hates me. She wants to run the whole factory, and she's jealous of the way you trust me."
"It isn't that at all, Mr. Clayton. I'm telling you openly and frankly, I don't trust this man."
"Why, you rotten
little..." "Don't use language like that, Stevens."
"All right. If I ever hear her talking about me like that again, so help me, I'll use something stronger than language on her."
"How did Stevens and Miss Manville behave to each other after this?"
"I forced them to make it up, but there was always a strain between them. It distressed me greatly. Then while I was worrying about this, I got a bad attack of arthritis, and the doctor ordered me to a health resort. And one night, just after I went to bed, about 10 o'clock... a long-distance call came through for me." "What's that?" "Oh. Hello, what is it?"
"Mr. Robert Clayton?"
"Yes?"
"Long-distance call for you. Here's your number."
"Yeah, thank you."
"Mr. Clayton, is that you?"
"Yes, who's speaking?"
"It's Rita Mandel."
"Rita, what's happened? Anything wrong at the factory?"
"I'm sorry, yes. Two of the hands just came to me and told me Stevens has been forcing them to give him part of their pay every week for the past 6 months in order to keep their jobs."
"Blackmail? It's outrageous."
"I always told you Stevens was a crook. Now I've got definite proof. When I accused him, he actually threatened my life."
"Why did you accuse him?"
"Well, I couldn't help it, Mr. Clayton. When I thought of the way he was taking advantage..."
"Never mind that. What did he say?"
"He said I was just a suspicious old busybody, and that the firm wasn't big enough for both of us anymore. I told him that this time I could prove my suspicions, that I was going to tell you as soon as you got back. And then he said perhaps I wouldn't get the chance. And that frightened me, so I thought I'd better call you at once."
"Yeah, you did right. I'll catch the first train back. I'll be at the factory by tomorrow afternoon. Don't talk to anyone about this till then."
"I won't. Goodbye, Mr. Clayton. I'll see you tomorrow."
But when I arrived at my factory, Rita was dead.
"I see, Mr. Clayton. Well, that is all. Your witness. Mr. Clayton, was Stevens the first person Miss Manville ever accused of theft in the factory?"
No, she accused several people at one time or another."
"Was she ever able to prove any of these accusations?"
"Sometimes yes, sometimes no."
"Is it not a fact that she was of a very suspicious nature, constantly suspecting and accusing people of cheating or robbing you?"
"I wouldn't say that. She merely was always watching out for my interests. She was very loyal."
"The two factory hands who were accusing Stevens of taking money from them, Did Rita Manville mention their names on the phone?
No, I didn't ask her. I didn't want her to mention names on the phone.
Since your return, has any one of your employees come to you privately with a statement that he or she paid money to Stevens?
No.
Has anyone come forward and told you Stevens took money from him or her?
No, nobody has.
That is all, Mr. Clayton. Thank you very much.
The Crown then called Jim Turner, machinist, one of the maintenance men at the Clayton factory. After he had given evidence about his routine duties, the Crown prosecutor asked,
And besides these general repair duties, did you have any other duties in the factory, Turner?
Yes, I was Miss Manville's bodyguard when she went to the bank for the payroll on Fridays.
How did it happen Stevens acted as her bodyguard the Friday she was shot and not you?
Well, I had to stay in the factory to fix the broken gear of one of the fitting machines. Well, Stevens went in my place.
Who put you to work on that broken gear?
Stevens did.
Did you usually carry a weapon when you accompanied Miss Manville?
Yes, always. A .38 caliber revolver in a shoulder holster.
Look at this revolver. Is it the one you always carry?
Yes, that's the one. I gave it to Stevens when he said he was going with Miss Manville that day instead of me. He took off his coat and put it on. I helped him to adjust it.
Now, Turner, while you were doing this, did you notice anything particularly about Stevens?
I did. I noticed a big bulge in his back pocket.
Did you remark about it?
Oh, I certainly did. Just as Stevens got his coat on, he said,
I ought to take care of anyone who tries anything.
What do you got there, another gun? Afraid mine isn't enough.
What are you talking about?
That bulge in your back pocket. It's a gun, isn't it?
Nothing of the sort. Mind your own business.
All right. I didn't mean anything.
Well, that is all. Your witness. Turner, there was bad blood between you and Stevens, wasn't there?
Oh, I wouldn't say that. I didn't like him much. But I never let my temper get the best of me.
Isn't it a fact that you asked him for a rise 3 months ago?
Yeah, I did.
And he turned you down.
That's true. What about it?
I suggest that out of revenge, you're putting the worst possible meaning to that bulge you saw in Stephen's back pocket.
No. I saw a bulge, all right.
But did you actually see a gun in his back pocket?
The bulge was the same shape as a gun.
I didn't ask you what shape the bulge was. I asked you and I asked you again. Did you actually see a gun in Stevens' back pocket?
Well, no, I didn't actually see a gun.
But you only saw a bulge that you're now trying to say looked like a gun, isn't that so?
Well, it looked like it.
Never mind what anything looked like. Did you or did you not see a gun in his back pocket?
I did not.
That is all.
This concluded the Crown case. The Crown prosecutor was not entirely satisfied, but he hoped to bring out more damaging evidence in cross-examination of the defense witnesses. In any event, he had proven by inference that the defendant had had a strong motive for disposing of Rita Manville, and her dying accusation, as attested by several witnesses, had made a great impression on the jury. We'll bring you the defense in just a moment, but first, a word from our announcer. Back to the courtroom and the trial of Frank Stevens. The defense had every air of confidence as it called its first witness, one Andy Martin, popularly known as Baldy, a small, nervous man of about 40.
What is your occupation?
I run a newspaper and cigarette kiosk next to the lane between the Associate Building and the Nash Tire Company.
How long have you been in business at this spot?
The past 6 years.
Were you in your kiosk just before noon on Friday, November the 9th?
Yes, I was. I heard shots in the lane next to my kiosk, and I heard a scream. I heard more shots, I looked out and saw a man running out of the lane.
You saw a man running out of the lane? What did he look like?
He was tall, dark complexioned. I couldn't see his face well, though. He had his hat pulled down low.
What was he wearing?
He had him a dark blue overcoat, grey felt hat. He's carrying a brown briefcase in his hand.
Did you notice in which direction he ran?
Yes. He was running up the street away from our kiosk. I stuck my head out further and watched him. Then Mr. Stevens came out of the lane with a gun in his hand, looked up and down the street.
Did you leave your stand and go into the lane?
No, I wasn't looking for trouble. I'm on my own business.
Oh, that is all. Thank you.
Mr. Martin, you say you mind your own business, and yet the minute you heard those shots, you leaned over the counter to see what was happening.
Yes, I did that. I didn't stop to think whether I was minding my own business or not.
What if?
I heard the shots, and before I knew what I was doing, I was looking out and seeing this fellow running out of the lane.
Very fortunate. That's all.
The Crown Prosecutor sat down with a discouraged look on his face. The defense's first witness had further weakened what was at best not too strong a case. Next, the defense called Frank Stevens, the defendant. A buzz of excitement swept the courtroom as he took the stand and was sworn in.
Mr. Stevens, tell His Honor and the jury the story of what happened when you escorted Miss Manville to the bank on November the 9th.
Well, we went to the bank and got the payroll. Rita put it in the brown briefcase and we started back. We walked through the lane. It was a shortcut to the factory, and we always used it. Then, about halfway through the lane, this fellow jumped out and grabbed the briefcase from Rita. Rita started to struggle with him, and he shot her twice. I tried to get my gun out, and he shot at me. Put a bullet through my hat. Then he ran up the lane towards the kiosk. I shot at him as I chased him, and I must have missed him. By the time I got to the street, I couldn't see him. Just then, the policeman came along.
And did you fire at the deceased?
Of course not. Those bullets came from a different gun, and I only had one.
Frank Stevens, did you ever ask for protection money from any employees of the Clayton Canning Company?
Never.
Was there any reason on earth why you should have wanted to kill Rita Manville?
Absolutely not.
That is all your witness. Stevens, you worked for Mr. Clayton for 7 years. What job did you hold before that?
I was assistant foreman in a pulp and paper mill.
And it was here that you were charged and convicted for robbing the factory safe, was it not?
Your Honor, I object. The defendant's past record has nothing to do with this case.
On the contrary, Your Honor, it has everything to do with it. Here is a man who obviously
knows. The question is allowed.
Well, Stephen, would you answer my question?
Yes, it's true. But I wasn't guilty. I was framed.
You were found guilty by a jury, and so were your two accomplices. Now, Stevens, you still keep your connections with the underworld, don't you?
No. I don't know anyone in the underworld. I never did.
But I suggest you do. I suggest you got a second gun from one of your underworld friends and used it on poor Rita Manville because she was going to expose your blackmailing activities to Mr. Clayton.
That's a lie!
Order!
I'm not going to...
Order! Order!
And I suggest that you got rid of the gun in a very simple way. The so-called hold-up man took it away with him, isn't that so?
Of course not.
That is all.
With your Honor's permission, I wish to re-examine the defendant.
Mr. Stevens, did your employer, Mr. Clayton, know about your prison record?
Yes, he knew. He believed I was innocent. He gave me a chance.
Have you been arrested or charged with any crime of any nature in the 7 years you worked for Mr. Clayton?
I have not.
That is all.
Counsel for the defense began his address by pointing out that the only concrete evidence against Stevens was the dying words of a jealous, half-delirious woman in mortal pain. He went on to state that no one single employee of the many in the factory had come forward to substantiate Miss Manville's statement that she had evidence of blackmail by Stevens. And above all...
Gentlemen of the jury, where is the weapon with which this crime was committed? It is not the weapon Stevens carried as a bodyguard. According to the prosecution, Stevens did the shooting. If so, what did he do with the revolver after he used it? Can a man kill a woman with a mysterious gun which nobody ever saw? and would simply disappear after the shooting? Why hasn't the prosecution produced it in court? Because the police have been unable to locate either the man who really committed this crime or the gun with which he did it.
As for the prosecution's fantastic story of a faked holdup, I leave that to your common sense.
I wish merely to point out there is not one single substantial witness against the defendant.
The court then adjourned for the day. Late that night, Baldy Martin, the kiosk proprietor, asleep in the shack in which he lived on the outskirts of town, was awakened by sounds down in the cellar. He got out of bed and went downstairs to investigate.
Who's that? What's going on here?
Heads up, Wally. Don't turn around. I'm behind you. It's a good thing you came down. I don't like to work in the dark. Now turn on the light.
Who are you?
Me? Roy Delaney. And I'm a mate of a certain friend of yours.
You mean...
That's just who I mean. Keep your hands up, Wally. Thought you were clever, eh? Going to disappear out of town with the cash tomorrow, eh?
I wasn't going
to... I told you to the railway station today. Planning to make a trip south, eh?
I didn't buy no ticket. I just asked what it cost. I wasn't meaning to leave town. Put down that gun, Roy. We can get together on a proposition. Just you and me. Nobody else has got another.
Yeah. Yeah, we can get together. And here's my proposition.
Savagely, Roy Delaney brought his gun butt down on Baldy's head. While he lay stunned, Delaney pulled a plank from the cellar floor and dug in the earth beneath with a shovel he found in the corner. In a few moments, he had what he was looking for, a brown briefcase. Bundling it under his arm, the intruder dashed up the stairs, slamming the door behind him.
All right. If that's the way he wants it, that's the way he'll get it. The rotten double-crosser. He's got the cash all right. But he's forgotten one thing. I've still got an ace in my hand, and I'm going to play it.
The next day, in court, the Crown prosecutor caused a sensation when he obtained the court's permission to reopen the case with vital new evidence. First, he called a police ballistics expert into the witness box. Then, recalled Baldy.
Do you wish to add to or change the evidence you gave yesterday?
You bet I do.
Look at this .32 caliber revolver. Is that the gun you brought to police headquarters last night?
Yes.
How long was this gun in your possession?
2 months. Kept it under the floor in the bedroom.
You've heard the expert state Miss Mandel was killed by bullets from this gun. Did you fire those bullets?
I did not.
Do you know who did?
Yes.
Who was it? Who killed Rita Mandel?
Frank Stephen.
It's a lie! Let me get him on that water, little!
The court was thrown into indescribable confusion as police guards struggled to keep Stevens from attacking the witness. Order was finally restored, and Baldy went on.
Stevens came to me the day before the murder, and he said...
Baldy, how would you like to earn £1,000?
£1,000? Are you kidding?
No, this is on the level. All you have to do is leave the little side door to your kiosk open tomorrow just before noon.
But what if...
Listen. Tomorrow I'm going with our bookkeeper to get the payroll. When we get in the lane next to your kiosk, I'll shoot her.
Not and... on your life. If there's any killing, you can count me out.
Have it your own way. You wouldn't like me to tell the police that you've been taking bets on the horses, would you?
What do you want me to do?
Just leave that little door next to the lane open. After I shoot her, I'll fire my own gun a couple of times and run up to your end of the lane as though I was chasing somebody. I'll throw the money and the other gun into your kiosk and you hide them. If anybody asks you anything, you saw a fella run out of the lane and up the street.
And what do I do with the cash and the gun? I don't want to get into trouble.
Just take the money home and hide it. Throw the gun in the harbour and neither of us will get into trouble. When everything blows over, we'll split the cash. And nobody's the wiser.
And what happened the next day?
He did just as he said he would. By the time the policeman got there, he'd thrown the stuff into my kiosk and I'd hid it in the empty box.
It's all lies! All of it!
I'm telling the truth, so help me God. But I didn't throw the gun in the harbour. I held on to it, just in case Stevens changed his mind and didn't give me my share.
He's lying! Look here, Judge! I didn't have nothing to do with it! Please, somebody listen to me! Please!
It was obvious at last that Stevens had committed cold-blooded, premeditated murder. The jury lost no time in returning a verdict of guilty. Stevens was sentenced to death. His partner in crime, Roy, was quickly apprehended, tried, and given a long jail sentence. Stevens' dupe, Baldy, was also given a jail sentence, mitigated somewhat by his help in serving the cause of justice. In a moment, I'll return with further news of these real-life dramas of the courts. But first, your announcer.
The court is adjourned until next week.
Be listening next week, same time, same station, when we present another real-life story in Dramas of the Court. This feature is a Grace Gibson radio production produced by Reg Johnston.